Production. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes. My name is Carl Shinneman. I'm Director of Analytics and Legal Review at Juranov. Of course, here at ESI Bytes, our goal is to present national speakers on electronic discovery topics at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and at a time when they're interested in listening to the topic, which is whenever they want to download it. Today, I'm really thrilled about our show because we've definitely got very good national speakers here presenting on EDD in everyday cases. And we've got Sharon Nelson and John Simic from Sensei Enterprises. Sharon is the past president of the Fairfax Bar Association, director of the Fairfax Law Foundation, and past chair of the American Bar Association's Tech Show Board. She's the chair of the ABA Law Practice Management Publications Board and currently serves on the governing council of the ABA's Law Practice Management Section. She's a member of ARMA's eDiscovery Advisory Board, the ABA Advisory Panel, the governing council of the Virginia State Bar, and graduate of Leadership Fairfax. She's also a very committed, like I am, very committed to education in the field. She's the co-host of the Digital Edge Lawyers and Technology, which is a popular ABA podcast. She's also the author of one of the leading blogs in the industry, Ride the Lightning, and she's written three books, co-author of three books on e-discovery. John Simic is the vice president of Sensei Enterprises. He's an NCASE-certified examiner and nationally known testifying expert in the area of computer forensics. He holds a degree in engineering from the United States Merchant Marine Academy and an MBA in finance from St. Joseph's University. And after forming Sensei, he ended his 20-year affiliation with Mobil Oil Corporation, where he'd served as a senior technologist designing and troubleshooting Mobil's networks throughout the Western Hemisphere. John's also very active in education. He's on the planning board of the American Bar Association's Tech Show, currently a member of the Boyd Graves Conference Subcommittee on Electronic Evidence. Hey, I'm glad to have both you guys on the show here today. This should be a good show.
Well, thanks. We sure appreciate you inviting us, Carl, and I think we both probably feel very tired after hearing our list of accomplishments.
Yeah, that was the abbreviated version.
Yeah, unfortunately, I know that.
Well, this is a really neat topic. In fact, the first ESI Bytes show was on why all lawyers need to learn about e-discovery. We had Judge Facciola on it, and I chose that as the first topic because I believe this is a very important topic, and I'm glad that you guys said this would make for a great show, because I agree. So starting off, Sharon, and actually, before we jump into these questions, I always like to know how you each got started in electronic discovery.
It was totally coincidence, actually. We ran into Peter Greenspun, the very famous criminal defense attorney, who did the Washington sniper case in which we were also involved. But back in the day, and this was 1999, he had an electronic evidence case, and he came to us when we were just doing legal technology. At that point, we weren't doing computer forensics at all, and he asked if we could help. He explained the case, and we looked at each other and said, sure, we can do this. So we did it, and that was the beginning in 1999, and we've been doing it ever since.
Wow. Okay. Well,
you notice Sharon says that. I was the one on the stand, not her.
I was just the woman behind the curtain.
We can mean a corporate entity.
Well, you notice who got the title president here.
All right. Well, how would you define everyday cases, Sharon, and what kind of types of cases do you see most often?
It's hard really to define it. I think you know it when you see it. It's like obscene, that definition in the Supreme Court. But the everyday cases, they tend to involve things such as criminal matters, divorce, and small business litigation. And I guess their hallmark is that money is limited, so you have to be smart about what computer forensics to do and what not to do. Generally speaking, in everyday cases, we conclude computer forensics at the end of the day, under $10,000 and certainly under $20,000, unless the case goes to trial, which very few cases do. You always have to include that potentially in the budget, but most cases, I would say less than 2% of the cases end up in court.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot to answer the second part of the question. Our workload is probably about 25% criminal, 25% divorce work, 25% theft of proprietary data, and the remaining 25 is a hodgepodge of everything, including rape and murder, things you wouldn't normally think about too much, but that's definitely part of the mix.
Well, you know, everybody wants to save money in these cases, and actually Tom French, who was the co-host with Judge Facciola, made a big point. He's a solo practitioner, and his point is, hey, if you can't afford to do it, you shouldn't be doing it. Better be prepared to spend it, or else you might be risking malpractice. So, you know, but saving money is what everyone wants to do, especially in these markets. So how do you do that, John?
Well, one of the first thing we do is we work with the attorneys, and we try to help narrow the scope of the effort and go after the what we call the low-hanging fruit. Primarily, we need to determine where the relevant data is. So if we know, as an example, we know the key players, the dates, you know, maybe the data types. Are we only talking about pictures, et cetera? We can narrow in on the evidence a lot faster than, you know, versus doing a buckshot approach if we don't know what we're looking for. And by low-hanging fruit, I mean that's the evidence that's going to be fairly easy to find, and we quickly get to the truth with it. As an example, we might be doing an email analysis on a case because we know there's a critical attachment in one particular message. So we don't need to waste time, you know, running through, carving out files from that may have been deleted in the past, et cetera. But it's been our sense that some vendors, they do this buckshot approach, and they do this exhaustive search, which certainly costs a heck of a lot more, rather than going through the low-hanging fruit theory.
You know, Sherry Harris did a really neat podcast with us. Even for larger cases, I think people lose sight of that
mm-hmm.
you really focus in on where, just like you did in the paper day, where most of the evidence is most likely to be found, and your tech spend will be much more controlled and more effective that way.
Oh, definitely, definitely.
And you may win the case off of that low-hanging fruit and never need to go any further. You may just display that low-hanging fruit to the opposing counsel, and the case is now over. And happily, that happens a fair percentage of the times.
Right.
Well, Sharon, I can tell you guys are business people because you started off right away by throwing out some numbers. You know, lawyers sometimes have a hard time saying what a case might cost overall. How have you been able to sort of get comfortable with cost estimates, and how do you figure that out?
Well, it took some time for us to get comfortable, but after so many hundreds of cases, we now have a pretty good sense of how much time the average case is going to take. So like many other computer forensics companies, we've developed a cost estimator, and it's pretty accurate. We'll generally give an estimate for the initial round of work, and then if more work is involved, there'll be a secondary estimate. So sometimes it goes in phases. To give you a very concrete example, if we have one computer in a divorce case, our experience has taught us what the average amount of time is that will be required to image and search the computer and then to analyze the results. So we know what that block might be. And then if there are multiple computers involved, it will, of course, change the amount of time. In the same way, as John said, if we're looking for a single smoking gun email and maybe we have the printed version of that email, that's really fast, so it's going to be cheap. But if we're going to look for hidden financial assets where we have to run a financial script and chase a lot of stuff down, that's clearly going to take a lot more time. So it does vary case by case.
Well, John, talking a little bit about preservation here, how do you preserve evidence when you're not sure whether you're going to use electronic evidence or not? And I want to add here, one of our dear friends that we share, David Reese, said this, or no, it wasn't, it was Bob Bernstein, who's a dear friend of David Reese. One further step removed.
Yeah, 6 degrees of separation.
We're
right?
Doing a podcast on Friday, but the you know, his lesson learned and e-discovery was, oh my God, preservation. If I'd only known about preservation starting off a case, I wouldn't have lost. You know, it's hard, you know, when you're starting this out. And I think, you know, it's an interesting area for people that maybe haven't done this before. So long question, John, how do you preserve evidence when you're not sure you're going to use it?
Well, certainly, you know, you hit the nail right on the head. The critical first step is preservation, is to preserve that evidence. There's a couple of ways to do it. The first is to create a forensic image of the hard drive. Now, that's going to require some specific knowledge and appropriate hardware, software to create those images. It might, frankly, be overkill because you're not really sure whether or not, you know, you're going to need it or not. What we usually recommend is in smaller cases, certainly, it's going to be more expensive to, and maybe cost prohibitive, to do the forensic imaging right from the get-go. So an alternative is to use a product like Norton Ghost or Acronis True Image, which the IT folks are very familiar with. They've used these products to clone computers and distribute them, et cetera. But what you want to do is make a copy of that original drive and then take the original drive and secure it off. So you're going to be running off of the copy drive. And that's fairly inexpensive to do that. The software is not real expensive, and as I said, the IT folks have knowledge of doing that. But securing the original drive is going to help preserve any of the unallocated clusters, and it will leave the drive intact for forensic imaging in the future if you need it, but you haven't expended that money up front. So that's one cost-saving tip, if you will, for smaller cases, and it also helps preserve the data. And then finally, you want to address any of your backup media, whether you're using external hard drives or tape. We're seeing less and less tape these days as backup, you know, for servers, et cetera. But you certainly want to, as a minimum, preserve, you know, one copy of that. Take a tape out of rotation or take an external hard drive out of rotation and purchase a new one, you know, in its place. But just taking that one little step, you know, as you said, you've preserved the data, and then 2 months, 3 months, whatever, down the road, maybe 6 months, you can say, okay, no, we're not going to litigation, so we really don't need to preserve the stuff anymore. But you certainly want to do it early on.
You know, in a smaller case, Sharon, you know, what are the appropriate litigation hold measures?
Well, I always show a slide when we present of David and Goliath, because the truth is, if you're a Goliath, if you're the Coca-Cola company, the courts are going to expect you to have a system in place, and they're not going to listen to a lot of weaselly excuses, not that Coca-Cola has ever given them, but I'm just saying, if you're a big guy, they're going to expect a lot. But if you're a mom-and-pop hardware store, they're not going to expect that you have a lot of sophistication. However, and it's a very big however, there are fundamentals that they expect individuals and small businesses and their attorney to understand. They've got to try to preserve the evidence, understanding that they're not really sophisticated, but they've got to make a good faith effort once they know that litigation is likely to take place or that a suit has already been filed. They certainly cannot delete things, and unfortunately, they often do. If they've received a reasonable preservation of evidence letter, they'll be expected to abide by its terms, and the attorney should know enough about electronic evidence, and this goes back to that first podcast you did, why is it important for all attorneys to know about this stuff. The attorney is supposed to be able to tell you what steps you should reasonably take. Unfortunately, many attorneys are still coming up to speed with electronic evidence, and frequently we see errors there. We recommend to help attorneys that the first thing they do is to confer with opposing counsel to get opposing counsel's agreement on whatever the preservation measures are. There's no percentage in hiding your cards in these cases. Might as well talk to the other side. You might as well decide to be reasonable about it and see if you can get some kind of agreement. If both sides are sensible and they agree at the outset, you're going to avoid all of those horrible hearings over electronic evidence that judges just hate. So it's better to be reasonable. And finally, the attorneys should be issuing preservation letters not only to the other side, but to their own clients as well, and they frequently forget that.
You know, this sort of popped up to me, and this may be a better John question, but you know, in these smaller cases, I would think I've been part of a business networking group, and you know, businessmen are, you know, like to make decisions that help them oftentimes, and sometimes they might think hitting a delete button is going to help them, and you know, how would anyone be able to prove this? Do you see a lot of that, of you know, people trying to hide files or get rid of them, and how easy is it to catch that?
Well, do we see a lot of it? It really depends. You know, certainly in the business cases of theft of proprietary data, the short answer is yes. You know, we do see that where folks are trying to take the company's data away and you know, cover up their trails. Some of the smarter ones, they'll try some of these tools that actually do, you know, selective targeted wiping of information so that you can't recover the deleted data. But in the end of the day, and for every case that we've ever had, I can say universally, if that kind of activity is going on, we can find that. We can find that particular software was installed, that it was uninstalled, that devices were inserted on certain days, as an example, external hard drive or flash drive, you know, which is pretty common, and that particular software may have been run. We may not be able to tell the actual data that was deleted at the time, but we can certainly see some activity. So I guess in the end, if you want to try to be one of the bad guys and delete all this stuff, you really can't hide your tracks. That's the short answer.
And the typical case, Carl, is that when they're supposed to turn machines over for imaging, it's, you know, in the week before sometime, invariably, that there's massive widespread deletions. And as John said, if you don't see it because they've simply deleted it thinking you can't find it, then you see the wiping tools. But when they're supposed to turn it over for imaging, it seems to be just an irresistible temptation to think you can get away with this stuff.
Yeah, and that's almost as good as finding the stuff.
It is. In fact, sometimes it's better because I don't know of a case where there's been an adverse inference instruction in anybody's what. That's the kiss of death, and that's what happens when you spoliate.
Okay. Well, John, you know, let's say everything's kosher and you know, you're gathering your evidence here. What format do you give this evidence in so that the attorneys can review it?
Well, for the smaller cases, it really depends on whether we're dealing with the logical data that, you know, that data that a user can see on their own, you know, if they went on the computer, or if we're having to deal with fragments of data in unallocated space, which generally we're not. But normally what we'll do is we'll give the attorney the files in their native format. So that's the format that they're typically stored, whether it's PowerPoint files or Word or Excel or things like that. Certainly, we'll log that information. We create a spreadsheet. It has the full path to every single file that we give the attorney, along with the file's hash value. And we do that so that we can preserve the chain of custody, et cetera, as to where these files may be, because there might be multiple files of the same name, but in different locations. So we need to make sure we have that full path captured. We also keep an exact copy of the information that we give the attorney. And the reason for that is most small cases, the attorneys are going to look at the data. They're going to review it. They may or may not be changing information, such as dates, access dates, typically, for those files. If that's important to the case, we still have the original. So when they say, I need, you know, these three files given over to the other side, complete with all the metadata, access whatever preserved, we still have that original file that we can make that preservation and produce over. But most of the time, the smaller lawyers, the smaller cases, they don't have the kinds of review tools that a lot of the larger cases and larger firms have. So they just review the files in their native form. They'll just open up the Word document or open the Excel spreadsheet or whatever it is. In conversion of files, though, we find that email is certainly number one. And if we will typically take email messages, convert them over into a single PST file so that the attorney can review those messages. Or if they don't have the software that's required to view some of the file formats, we will actually convert them to PDF for them so that they can review that information as well. And again, at the end of the day, we still have the original files, so we can produce them in their original native form, non-converted, if that's required.
Sharon, a lot of people listening, if they're in smaller cases, might not know how to pick a good EDD vendor. And, you know, obviously I've read your credentials on the show, so I would consider you guys to be excellent EDD vendors. And, you know, obviously Juranov does a lot of the same things you do. So we're secure in our ability to perform to have you on a show at the same time. So, but outside of our sample of our two organizations, how would you pick a vendor?
Well, there's more to the answer first than you might think, and thank you for the compliment. There's always plenty of work in this field, and it's nice to have friends.
That's right.
The best source, if you really don't know, you know, anybody out there in this field, but you got to find somebody, the best source is always a referral from someone who's used the vendor. Then you can ask that person, you know, was this vendor responsive if you left an email or message? What was the quality of the product? If they had to do a forensic report, how good was it? Were all the deadlines met? And was the cost reasonable given the scope of the work? So you can ask all of those things. That's the best way. The worst way is just to go to the internet and just start searching, because so many vendors look good and have put a lot of money into shining on the internet, but there's not a lot of substance behind. And frequently, you can't even tell where they're located, which is a real tip-off to me that there's something wrong there. Since you generally know going into a case whether you're likely to wind up in trial, you want to assume that you will, and at least make sure that your expert speaks English clearly. And I mean that in two ways. Can your expert speak the English language well, clearly, so that they're understood? Many jury members do not have English as their first language. So someone who tends to mumble or somebody who has a very heavy accent, it may be hard for them to be understood. Also, they've got to bring a very, very technical subject down to a level that a jury or even a judge who may not know ESI that well can understand. So as an example, you can't talk in acronyms without explaining them, and you have to be able to use things like TV analogies or sports analogies, something that regular people can understand. I mentioned before that there's some duplicity sometimes when you look at stuff on the internet. You also really want to look at the expert's resume. We see so many experts claiming to have a forensic certification when, in fact, all they have is a certificate of attendance at some sort of training. There's just a lot of puffery in these CVs, so I would recommend that folks be kind of skeptical. It's helpful if the vendor has spoken and written on computer forensics and e-discovery, because that's a plus. Judges and juries like that, and they naturally respect those people. It helps if there's an attorney associated with the firm, simply because knowledge of the law is so pivotal in computer forensics. I help our guys a lot with that. As gifted as they are, they can't be expected to know what's legally significant in every case, so I can really help them as they go through the search protocols. And I referred to certifications being important, so let me say that currently the two most prestigious computer forensics certifications are the ENCE, which is the NK Certified Examiner, which is granted after testing by Guidance Software, and the CCE, the Certified Computer Examiner, which is vendor neutral. That will change over time. We'll see other certifications emerging, and John and I hope to see more vendor neutral certifications as time goes by.
Actually, Sharon, you raised a real neat point in there about the attorney background, because, you know, one of the things I've always felt, and I did a show last night with Brett Burney on project management, is the communication breakdowns causing issues and the lack of understanding, you know, between technology and law, and being able to bridge that gap is really hard to, you know, overemphasize how useful that is. It's easy to find technologists. But why are you doing this?
That's true. It's also true that attorneys are comfortable speaking to their own kind, if you will.
For some reason.
Yes, and God knows why. I mean, and John, don't say a word. He gets us in trouble.
There are two attorneys on the call, John. You're outnumbered.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Carl's got control. He can edit it out anyway.
Anyway. Well, John, you know, why shouldn't you use a client's IT department to save money?
Well, they may be very good at what they do, but most of the IT folks, they don't have any training concerning preservation of evidence, and many, many times we see the IT folks end up stomping all over the evidence, looking for what may have been deleted or trying to see how much trouble they're in, and it's a very natural, you know, thing to do. And they're typically reacting to what one of their managers has said. You know, somebody has left or they just got a lawsuit over patent infringement or whatever, and they go to their IT folks and say, hey, give me all the data that you've got. So now they're out there changing all the dates and times potentially associated with any of this information, and possibly even what user ID might have created some of this activity. So they're basically, as I said earlier, stomping on the evidence. But another problem is that the IT folks, again, they're very good at what they do, but they in fact have a vested interest in the outcome. So they've got great intentions, but the opposing party is going to claim that the company manipulated and tainted the evidence. They'll argue that it shouldn't even be allowed in, or failing that, they'll argue that it shouldn't be given much weight because it was potentially compromised. So you've got that area there to kind of be concerned with, and that's one of the reasons we certainly don't recommend that the IT department be used to preserve and gather this data.
Sharon, you know, one of the things that's been thrown out quite a bit is this collaboration initiative that Sedona wrote about, and the collaboration proclamation. I had Judge Grimm on a podcast a couple weeks ago, and He's had some case law where he's really highlighted this. You know, for the smaller case, how important is it to work with opposing counsel?
Well, I think it's more important there than perhaps anywhere else, simply because there's no money to fight. In the smaller cases, it's ridiculous that you have all these hearings in court. So if you can meet with the other side, whether it's by phone or in person, and of course, if it's a meet and confer in federal court, it's supposed to be for sure in person. It's really important, not just in preservation, which I had mentioned previously, but in so many other areas. You can talk right away with opposing counsel about how the computer forensics is to be conducted and come up with a computer forensics protocol. You can discuss search methodologies. You can discuss production format and whether metadata is likely to be important in the case. You can determine the reasonable amount of time for the discovery to take place beyond that which the court has set. You can establish dates, and sometimes there can be rolling production dates. You can stipulate, this is one of my favorite tips, you can stipulate as to the authenticity of electronic evidence to save a lot of time in court. Now you don't have to go through the authentication process. In most courts, if you've stipulated to authenticity, it's in. That's it. But you've got to get both sides to agree. So I could go on and on, but my basic message is that you should try, if possible, to work together. Courts are really sick and tired of the infighting that goes on during the discovery process and the necessity sometimes of having multiple hearings to get things worked out, and sometimes these things drag on for years. So the courts are tired of it. Best avoided.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, but this collaboration effort, I do some podcasts also on everyday law, sort of a real hobby. And I've done a show on divorce and the collaboration initiative. And I compared it to e-discovery. And I said, you know what? It's interesting how sometimes the lawyers recognize their system isn't working very well. And a bunch of smarter lawyers get together and say, we got to do something different, like collaborate. And my sense is when you see lawyers talking about things like that, there's a recognition that something doesn't work and it's something that should be explored. Unless you want to spend a lot of money.
Well, you know, the occasional problem is that you'll get somebody on the other side who no one could work with. This person is just determined to be a problem, and they won't agree to anything, and they're just – there are words for those people, and I'm not going to use any of them because this is a podcast. But judges don't like those people, and I know judges have told me personally that if they see a person like that – arguing over nothing and being completely irrational, the judge says, I will remember that guy's name, and God help him when he comes back into my court a second time. So that's the good news. The bad news is when you run into those people, you do have to deal with them.
We're into sort of the last question here, and I love this area, you know, mistakes, because I think that's where we all learn the most. So John and Sharon, if you want to chime in on this, where do you see attorneys make the most mistakes in smaller cases?
Well, I think, Carl, you mentioned at some point time back there that probably the biggest mistake we see is the failure to preserve, and preserve early. Too many times we get brought into the case after the during discovery phase, and the computers that are at issue here, they're still being used, and they've been used for months after preservation should have taken place. So you've got all this activity that's been going on these machines, which certainly makes things a lot more difficult, and Sharon mentioned spoliation earlier. She also mentioned about not only putting the other side on notice, but making sure your own client has taken adequate preservation steps. That's an area that we see lacking a lot of times. Other thing that we see is that the attorneys, they fail to tell the clients not to let the IT staff near the computers, which, you know, I previously mentioned. And then finally, we see attorneys failing to spell out in explicit terms how damaging spoliation can be to a case. And we've talked around this a little bit, but there are huge fines that the courts are likely to give now, and we're seeing more and more of these now. But sanctions for spoliation, they're being handed out like Pez candy these days, and I'm not so sure that I have a sweet tooth for that.
And you know what? I mean, we're only talking here about a sample of the mistakes that you're seeing. You know, they're the ones that we read about and we hear people talk about, which is attorneys not getting involved with people that know e-discovery or not knowing it that well.
Right.
And, you know, and Judge Facciola made a point in the podcast that we did about, you know, he thinks that a lot of lawyers commit malpractice in this area.
Oh, absolutely. The first mistake they make is thinking they know more than their experts. If you're going to hire an expert, for heaven's sakes, listen to them. And frequently we have people telling us what to do that isn't correct, and that's a real issue.
And if you want more information on that, I did a podcast with Ralph Losey on the ethical issues of lawyers not learning this area. Ralph's done some really nice blog posts on this topic as well.
Well, you've had some stellar names on your podcast there.
Yeah, I don't know why we're in this club, man.
No, you believe me. If you're in, you're in. Okay? You've earned your way in.
Well, as Groucho Marx once said, I wouldn't be a member of any club that would have me. So.
Hey, this is a very open club. We had a second-year associate on, Megan O'Donnell, with Judge Facciola, because we were doing it on privilege logs. And I wanted to have an associate that was close to it. She's also written an article for the ABA. And I think there are a lot of people that add value to this. It's not mm-hmm. always the same old people. But, heck, if you know the stuff, you know it for a reason. You've been doing it for a while. So on that note, you know, I'll teach you the secret handshake when I see you next. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Make sure you send the decoder ring, too.
Okay. And, you know, I just want to let everyone know that if you want to hear more of the superstar celebrities on other shows, you can go to www.esibytes.com, where we've got a full list of podcasts on a range of topics. Certainly use our scroll bar on the right, which is broken down by topic, like the EDRM model or by guest speaker. The second thing is, you know, we say you should come to ESI Bytes, where we teach you about e-discovery before ESI bites you back. So thanks again, and everyone, have a nice day.
Thanks very much,
Carl. Thanks,
Carl.